What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station today on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
You know, you pay more than $8 for a pair of headphones and earbuds, you would think that they'd last more than 5 years, right? Don't you think for $8 you would think a pair of earbuds would last more than 5 years? Well, mine collapsed. That's why the pause. I apologize for that. Patrick Penfield joins us now, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. How you doing, Patrick?
I'm doing well, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. I didn't see the point in proceeding if I couldn't hear you or me. It would seem as though that would make things intensely more difficult.
I agree.
Okay, let's talk about grocery prices, because I've mentioned, I understand this is anecdotal, but the last half a dozen times I've gone to the grocery store, without fail, I have seen people looking at their receipts as they walk away from the checkout, and I've not normally seen that.
Yeah, Tommy, I'm the same way, and I do a lot of my own grocery shopping. And yeah, tariffs are driving food prices up. So without a doubt, we're starting to see that impact.
So where does it end?
Well, it really doesn't. So unfortunately, we're going to see, I guess when the prices start to top out right after the tariffs are been included. But unfortunately, just starting to see prices increase throughout the whole supply chain.
Why are we seeing it now?
Well, I think it's because with food, you can't really build up inventory. So, it's one of those things that it's consumed, it spoils. So, whatever we bring in, that's what the price is going to be.
Are there any particular food products that are affected more than others?
Yeah, I think your listeners are going to see coffee prices really start to jump up high. You know, almost a 50% increase that we're going to be getting.
What?
Taxing. Yes, taxing Brazil. But a third of what we get from coffee comes from Brazil. But unfortunately, you're going to see a huge increase. And that, that's going to come throughout the whole supply chain. Olive oil, chocolate, imported wine, spices. These are all things that are really going to start to go up in price.
What can people do to try to offset some of this?
Yeah, I think, you got to, maybe buy store brands, try to buy in bulk, try to shop as much as you possibly can, look to see who's offering the best prices.
And what about other products that this might be affecting besides coffee?
Yeah, produce is one I'm concerned about. So, we've got a lot of produce that we grow here in the States, but we do import a lot. And so, unfortunately, you're going to start seeing that. And that's usually my biggest expense when I go grocery shopping, is just trying to get fresh produce. And so you'll start to see more of that.
So does it affect the produce like apples that are not in season here that we get from other countries, or plums? Or I don't know how the seasons go, but is it primarily imported fruit, or are there costs that are passed along to the farmers that even produce the food here?
Yeah, and that's true, Tommy. So, fertilizer costs have gone up, labor costs have gone up. So you'll see, domestically those prices have gone up. But, yeah, anything that we import from another country besides Mexico and Canada, you're going to be seeing, significant increase.
What kind of increases are we talking about?
I'd say roughly about 5%, from a produce standpoint. But, again, it's going to be one of those things where, this will be a lot more than this. And so it's on an average. And so that's the unfortunate thing. When you keep going to the grocery store, you're just going to be paying more. And if you've got a big family, it hurts. And I know how that is, because they eat so much.
Yeah. When it comes to the inflation ratings, or however they count that, do they factor in tariffs or not? I'm just wondering about the numbers that we see about inflation.
Yeah, so that should be included in the overall numbers. And so, again, we've started to see it's a 3% increase from last year, based on what happened in July. But, yeah, that is included in the overall price increase, Tommy.
So at what point do tariffs come off, or how long would it take for the prices to revert to what they were before tariffs?
The only way that'll happen is if, again, there's some, huge amount of food supply, or, again, there's more supply than demand. But usually what happens with food prices, when they go up, they keep going up. So normally we don't see them really come down after, you know, especially with your packaged foods. Usually, you know, when you increase your Oreo prices, they never come down. They just keep going up.
When it comes to other products, not food, how are tariffs affecting them, whatever we have to buy at the store?
Yeah, everything's just going up. You know, your sneakers, your shoes, your apparel, you know, anything, cars, you know. And we'll start, your listeners will start seeing more of that probably in the September-October time frame. Then it'll start to be more. It's been kind of gradual, and that's because a lot of companies have brought in inventory to kind of buffer against price increases.
Mm-hmm.
But the inventory is running out, Tommy. And so, you know, these companies, they've got two choices. Either we make more money or we lose money. And, you know, most of these companies, they're going to charge more just because they can't afford to lose money.
So what about on the other side of it? Are companies relocating here or not? Because that was the idea. It is generating money for the Treasury, and I get that. But is anybody relocating here? I know they've had a lot of promises about we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But then that brings up the question of, are they just trying to tell President Trump what he wants to hear and ride out his administration to see what happens and get the tariffs taken off? Although in some cases it hasn't happened because the tariffs are still on. Tell me about that. Tell you what, Patrick, tell me about that when we come back. It's 6:20. Tommy Tucker talking about tariffs and prices at grocery stores. And I'd like to hear from you at 504-260-1870. That's the Oakland Art Jeweler talk and text line, please. Don't ever text and drive. Some of the texts that are coming in. Country's bleeding us dry. Yesterday on the way home from work, my wife asked me to get her and the three kids each a snack. I bought each of them a candy bar and a new stick of deodorant. It was $20, getting absolutely ridiculous. Another one says, think grocery prices are high. How about cable TV going through the roof? Well, you don't need cable TV. Somebody else said they buy coffee in bulk from Costco and they've already seen a $3 increase. Somebody else texted and said, my 401k is booming, though, LOL. Well, that's good, but does it help you day to day? And a lot of people don't have 401ks, and they're struggling with these prices. We'll talk about maybe who is struggling more than others when we come back. 6:21 traffic, WWL. 6:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. I'm getting some text here. One of them's talking about the price of vehicles. I just bought a new truck. And it was $40,000, and that I got a pretty good deal on it to get it for $40,000. So where do you see that heading? Do tariffs have a lot to do with that, or cars just forever going up?
Yeah, tariffs have a lot to do with that, Tommy. So you're going to see that just because of the price of steel and aluminum have gone up, and you have to import a lot of stuff. And then, you know, we're, you know, it's a global supply chain, especially for the automotive industry. And so they're, you know, constantly, you know, trying to, you know, get parts from other countries. So, yeah, unfortunately, tariffs are going to be impacting the price of cars. And a lot of your listeners will see that again. Probably September, October, you're going to start to see prices go up.
All right. So I paid $40,000 for this Honda Ridgeline truck, which, again, I think I got a pretty good deal on. But 5 years from now, is that same truck going to be $90,000?
Possibly, Tommy.
Wow.
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, it seems like each year everything just keeps going up more and more.
I think I'm going to keep it in the garage and sell it in 5 years. Somebody texted in and said, we never would have been in this situation had we kept our manufacturing here in the United States in the 90s. We manufactured way more and we wouldn't be in this situation. First of all, I don't know if that's true about the 90s. Secondly, what is it that led to the manufacturing going off overseas?
Companies looking to reduce costs, Tommy. So that's kind of what it was, trying to increase profits. And so, you know, we saw this outsourcing of a lot of industries, you know, going overseas because labor costs are so cheap. Your listener is absolutely correct. We did lose a lot of wealth when we started to move manufacturing offshore.
So, but why did it move offshore?
For more corporate profits, you know, be able to make more money for these companies.
Because the labor was cheaper.
Exactly, Tommy.
So did they keep the prices down, or did they just increase the profits with cheaper labor?
Increase the profits for the most part, you know, with cheaper labor.
Now, you just said a mouthful there, because what that's saying is it helped companies and stockholders get richer while the consumer were the ones paying the price, but they didn't have the benefit of the jobs because the jobs were overseas. And what you hear all the time is that labor was cheaper, and that kept the prices down, but it really didn't.
Yeah, Tommy, I mean, it's like anything, you know, it's capitalism, right? So, you know, most companies, again, are looking for, you know, the best opportunity to make more money. And so, you know, that's been ongoing, you know, since capitalism started. I think for the most part, I think your listener is right. I mean, manufacturing creates wealth, and it's good to manufacture in the United States. We need to manufacture in the United States. It's just got to be the high technology type stuff. That's the stuff that we want to produce.
So somebody texted in and said, July call, they want its tariffs discussion back. Hold things in the rearview mirror. Fuel is down and going lower. Border 100% closed. And criminal aliens going home. American jobs are up. Aliens going off of Medicaid and SNAP. We're building more cars in U.S. now. War might end winning. Be positive. Apparently a big MAGA fan there. And that's fine. Everybody's entitled to what they want, but their own opinions. But as far as tariffs go, they are affecting prices, right? I mean, who's winning this other than the U.S. Treasury?
Yeah, absolutely, Tommy. Yeah, prices are going up. And again, for your listeners, if you hear that the United States is collecting more and more money, somebody's paying for that, Tommy, and that's usually the companies that are importing that stuff, and they eventually will have to raise prices. So it's just part and parcel of, you know, this tariff situation. You know, you're getting hit with the cost, you got to raise your costs.
Somebody's paying for it, and it's going in the U.S. Treasury, which would be fine if we would either see the debt paid off or a tax cut, but that's not happening either, is it?
That's not happening at all, Tommy.
Okay. Just trying to follow the dollars. That's all I'm doing. Not making it political. Just following the money. Thank you, Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. We'll come back. We're going to talk to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book, Russian Politics, a very short introduction. We'll recap President Trump's meetings with Putin and then Zelensky and other European leaders when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm looking at a screen here, a forecast on TV saying that the Gulf is closed for now because of some different steering systems. So don't be worried about whatever's coming off the coast of Africa. It's far too early to even think about it. However, we will keep an eye on it for you. We're joined now by Brian Taylor, our friend, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book, Russian Politics, a very short introduction. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. So I'm trying to get a list of who exactly Trump met with. I know he met with Zelensky, the leader of the European Union, the German prime minister, right? I get the titles confused. Who else was there?
So,
Macron was there with the president of France.
Yeah, so we had the Ukrainian president, the European Union leader, the British prime minister, the French president, the Finnish president, the Italian prime minister, the German prime minister, and the NATO secretary general. So in addition to Zelensky, seven other important European leaders dropped everything to fly to Washington to sort of backstop Zelensky and his discussions with President Trump.
Entirely different meeting than when Zelensky was there the first time by himself. And what made me say that is when you said backstop. It did change the dynamic of the room, I'm guessing?
It did. And the meeting that everyone was worried about, where President Trump and President Zelensky were in the Oval Office and they let in the media, everyone had, you know, fears of a repeat of the February meeting, but it didn't happen that way. Everyone was on their best behavior. No one was telling anyone that they didn't have any cards or they didn't say thank you often enough or any of those things. So then they went from that meeting to a closed door meeting and then the meeting with the European leaders. And the mood was certainly more positive. And if the meeting in Alaska had everyone afraid that, you know, Putin was winning the upper hand, the meeting in D.C. basically pushed things back to zero again. So the war continues. There is no ceasefire. There are no new sanctions. And as is often the case, Donald Trump is at the center of everything, which is how he likes it.
Let me go back to the meeting with Putin and the press conference or whatever it was on Friday. I saw it. And this is, I know people that love President Trump are going to get mad here, but I thought that Vladimir Putin was terribly disrespectful to the president. I thought he made him his blank. And I wasn't happy about the way that unfolded at all. Thoughts?
Well, I think Putin thought, coming out of the meetings he had had, that he had achieved everything he set out to achieve. And we saw over the next couple of days that President Trump changed his position from saying we need a ceasefire first and then a peace agreement to saying we don't need a ceasefire. We can have an agreement without it. Trump had said before the meeting that if they didn't make progress, there would be new sanctions. Then he came out saying there wouldn't be any new sanctions. But most worryingly for the Ukrainians, President Trump seemed to have adopted several of Putin's positions about what a settlement would look like, including forcing Ukraine to give territory to Russia that Russia hasn't even conquered yet, and critical territory from the point of view of the Ukrainian military. So I think part of the reason everyone among the European leaders dropped everything to come to Washington was to try to convince President Trump that his message coming out of Anchorage was not going to get the deal done, and it was just going to put Ukraine in an untenable position. And in that sense, at least, things are better than they were after what happened in Anchorage. And I agree with you. The meeting in Alaska, I think, was kind of unnecessary, and it seemed odd to see the U.S. military down on their hands and knees rolling out a red carpet for the person who launched the largest war in Europe since World War II.
Yeah, again, I'm not trying to criticize President Trump here, but it just seems like you had a president trying to curry favor with Putin, and Putin was like the stuck-up cheerleader that had no interest at all and was looking at him with contempt. Am I wrong?
Well, it's interesting. There was a sound.
No offense to cheerleaders.
No, it's certainly not in Louisiana.
Wait, what?
There was a clip that came out of the meeting yesterday off a what they call a hot mic, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't think President Trump knew anyone was listening, but he was telling French President Macron that he really think Putin wants to do a deal with him. And ultimately, I think the problem here is there's no evidence that Putin wants a deal unless that deal is Ukrainian capitulation. Otherwise, the war is going to continue. But for whatever reason, President Trump still seems to think Putin wants to come around on this when he hasn't shown any interest in that in the last 3.5 years.
Did you say Putin wants Ukraine to give up territory that Russia hasn't even conquered yet?
That's correct. Wow. That's correct.
Wow. I can't believe that Trump would sign off on that, would he? Or did he seem that he would?
Well, part of the problem, I think, is that, again, not to offend any listeners, but I think most people would agree that Donald Trump is not really a details person, right? Mm-hmm. He sort of thinks
big
about it in
guy.
Terms of the
yeah.
big picture. But if you look at the way Ukrainian defenses are set up and the territory that Putin is asking for, it would sort of open up much of the rest of Ukraine for the Russian military. And Putin's quote-unquote concession was to give back a very small sliver of territory in an inconsequential area. And I don't think Mr. Trump or Mr. Witkoff, his real estate friend who's been doing a lot of these negotiations, really understood the gist of what they were talking about. And it sounds like yesterday some of the European leaders, such as the Finnish president, President Stubb, managed to convey to Trump how important this territory is and why they can't just give it away. So
this is about sovereignty of a nation, not a real estate deal.
Yes, that's the real problem. I think, Trump thinks, oh, we can just, do something that will satisfy everyone. But Putin wants Ukraine, and Ukraine doesn't want to be under Putin's control. And that's been the essence of the conflict, really, for even before the full-scale invasion in 2022. And that's still the essence of the conflict now.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Somebody texted in, and you can respond to this, Brian, when we come back, that land for peace never, ever works. And they cited the Sudetenland. They also cited Gaza. 652, 8 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Somebody texts in about land for peace never works. Your thoughts on that, Brian?
Well, being a professor, I hate to use the word never because we can probably come up with some examples in which it was an important part
generally
of the deal.
Generally
speaking, I think that's true, and I think a really important way in which the world changed after World War II is the international order pretty much does not accept territorial conquest and redrawing of borders by force anymore. And what Russia is trying to do if I can use a multisyllabic word here, is recolonize something that had been part of the Russian Empire, which they had agreed to give up, agreed on new borders with Ukraine, and then Putin comes along and says, well, we've changed our mind, we want this territory back. And that's not the way it's supposed to work these days. And I think this is why Ukrainians are so insistent that they want some guarantee going forward that if they temporarily agree to stop the fighting and, you know, recognize the current front line as at least a temporary accommodation, that they're going to have European and other support to make sure Russia doesn't do it again in a few years.
Brian, you wrote the book, Russian Politics, very short introduction. How would President Trump most effectively deal with Putin? Because, look, this guy celebrates 50 years in the KGB. I think I would, if I were with him, I would recognize what he was doing and say, ah, you Russian SOB, you're not doing that on me, and I'd walk out the room. What's the best way for Trump to handle this?
I think your instinct is right in that Putin is only going to be forced to give up on his dream of reconquering Ukraine if he is prevented from doing so on the battlefield. And that means putting pressure on him. And Zelensky said coming out of the meeting yesterday that Ukraine has agreed with the help of the Europeans to buy $90 billion worth of U.S. military aid. Mm-hmm. That will make a bigger impression on Putin than any flattery would.
Recolonization is only four syllables, Brian. Take it easy.
Yeah, not that long, I guess, but it's kind of a funky word.
Yeah,
but
I'm not that dumb.
Hopefully the point is clear.
The point is clear, but I'm not that dumb. I'm just kidding. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate your time. We'll take a break, come back, talk about Kratom. It's 7:14 now, and there are a couple of systems out in the Gulf, not in the Gulf, in the Atlantic, none of which are threatening us, not even systems, waves. And I just saw a meteorologist on TV talking about the Gulf being closed because of ridges and this and that. So nothing to worry about other than hot and humid with a chance for showers like normal in August. And considering we're heading into the teeth of hurricane season, I guess we'll take it. Krista McCurdy joins us now, professor of medicinal chemistry at the University of Florida College of Pharmacy. Talk about Kratom. How you doing, Doc?
Doing great. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. You guys watching hurricane season as well as us, huh?
Oh, yeah. All the time.
Yeah. I hate it because in Cleveland it's just summertime, but here we go. So I mentioned earlier before we went on the air that before you came on that I hurt my back about a year and a half ago, and I tried some of this Kratom 7, whatever it was, OH, before it was illegal, obviously, a year and a half ago. And I got to tell you, this was stronger than any medication I had when I had two knee replacements. And it amazed me that this would be legal and on the shelf and available to anybody. Thoughts?
Yes, we've been studying it for a number of years, and we knew from about 2016 that it was a very potent opioid, a pure opioid, just like what you would get at a prescription from a pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And so we've been studying the abuse potential of it since then, and we've been sounding an alarm from a scientific perspective that this was out there and available and could be potentially dangerous.
So what does the science show about this stuff? Because I got to tell you, Doc, from my personal experience, again, having had two knee replacements and having had some very strong opioids, this was stronger than anything like that at all.
Yeah, I can't speak from any personal experience on it, but what I can tell you with the animals that we've worked with, it's high abuse potential. And so we've done all of the gold standard testing that is required by the FDA to show abuse potential of a substance. And that's what the DEA would then use to place items into the Controlled Substances Act. And this meets all of the criteria for a controlled substance. And so it is very powerful. It's more powerful than morphine, not as powerful as fentanyl. And we don't know really where the danger is in between those two. We know how dangerous fentanyl can be. But we just don't know how dangerous this is in humans.
Along those lines, you know, a big problem with fentanyl and people buying pills off of the street. Let me just make my case here and you can respond to it. People are going to find a way to alter their consciousness, whether it's paint, whether it's booze, whether it's spray things for the computer, where I've seen shows where these people are inhaling thousands of these things. We also took, I think, nitrogen off of the market or whatever it was that people were inhaling, helium, whatever it was, I forget, with these, well, I forget what it was. Recently, the legislature took it off the air, off the market. But I guess what I'm wondering is, so people can find a way to alter their consciousness. They buy pills off the street, which sometimes are poorly mixed, and they get all the fentanyl, and somebody else doesn't get any, and the person who gets all the fentanyl dies. So when it comes to this kratom, was there the same problem with this, where you get a bad batch of kratom, you die, or was there some measure of quality control over it, or do you know?
It's a great question. We really don't know. There's not much quality control over it. What they do to produce the 7-OH materials is actually take a very concentrated enriched extract from the kratom plant itself, and then they treat it with chemicals. So they do what we call a semi-synthesis or a synthetic procedure to create the 7-hydroxy, but it also converts everything in the extract into an oxidized byproduct. And so these pills are actually being sold with no quality control at all, and there's a whole mixture of things in there, some of which we haven't been able to identify yet and understand really what the ramifications of those things are, because they could be toxic in and of themselves. But so far, we haven't been hearing of people dying like we've heard with fentanyl overdoses from a rapid rate, but it's also not been something that's really being monitored for until earlier this year. 7-hydroxymitragynine is the actual name of the compound, mm-hmm. and it hadn't been monitored for at all by poison control centers or emergency rooms, and it's still not very widely done.
And I'm just wondering, trying to play devil's advocate as I always do, if this wouldn't be better if there was some kind of quality control standard, then people buying pills off the street and getting bad pills and dying from one pill, as some young people have done here in the area and all over the country. And again, I'm not trying to make an argument for kratom. I'm just saying that people are going to do, Doc, whatever they can to sometimes alter their consciousness.
Yeah, no doubt. So let me be clear. This is not kratom. This is a semi-synthetic product.
You know what?
That's produced from kratom.
An important distinction, and I want to pick it up there when we come back, all right? Difference between kratom,
yep.
7.0, whatever you call it, and by the way, nitrous oxide is what the legislature also made illegal in Louisiana. 720, more about kratom when we come back. You got any thoughts, text them in to 504-260-1870. Somebody texted in and said, listening to your show regularly, I have determined that you are a medical catastrophe. Actually, just the opposite. Problem is, I'm not 30, and I'm still acting and living like I'm 30. Traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Christopher McCurdy, professor of medical chemistry at the University of Florida College of Pharmacy. He says kratom 7.0, I believe, or 7-OH, we'll get to that in a second, is a pure opioid available without a prescription, so it's akin to having morphine or oxycodone for sale at a smoke shop or a gas station. It's a public health crisis waiting to happen. Somebody texted in, doctor, and said, I don't know if anyone has taken kratom that was mind-altering. It just stopped the pain. Well, the 7-OH that I took was like nothing else I'd ever taken, and I knew I didn't want to take it again because it was like oxycodone and whatever they gave me after the knee surgery on steroids. It was ridiculous. So tell me about the difference between kratom and are you referring to it as 7-HO, or how do you call it that? What is it?
7-OH.
Okay. Tell me the difference.
Sometimes it's just called 7. So 7-OH is actually a metabolite of one of the main compounds that's found in kratom, and our body produces it. So it's not a foreign substance for people who are taking kratom. However, it's produced in very small amounts. Mm-hmm. And what is being done, as I mentioned before, it's not kratom any longer. It's a byproduct of the kratom plant that has been chemically manufactured and packaged, and it is a pure opioid. Kratom is very different. Kratom is a tree that's been in Southeast Asia for centuries with really no issues, and the leaf material is not problematic. It's not really mind-altering. However, as you make it into these very concentrated products, it becomes a different substance. And then this product, 7-OH, is a synthetically produced product that is not any longer a natural product like kratom. It's not derived. It's not from the tree any longer. It's actually chemically made.
So I think
it's pure opioid in detection.
I think pure opioid. I think the state made all kratom illegal. Did they go too far with that? Did they take something off the market that could have helped people that was not necessarily problematic? And should they have focused on the 7-OH? If I'm saying
so, I think the problem is, the problem is that it's hard to tell the difference at this point. And I think that's why some legislators are confused, because the public is confused. A lot of individuals are confused. Physicians really don't even know about 7-OH and it being different. Many people are calling all of these things kratom. And kratom is not all equal. As I said before, we have the leaf material, which is more similar to the traditional form that's been used in Southeast Asia. And then we have concentrates, that are very potent, liquids that are very different from the way it was intended to be used traditionally. And then we have these 7-OH products that aren't even kratom anymore. Yet they all get thrown into the same bag as kratom, if you will. So when someone goes to purchase it and they say they want to try kratom or they want kratom, some of the vendors or smoke shops, gas stations are even selling the 7-OH as kratom products. Some of the products are labeled as kratom. And so in order to be overly cautious, I think legislatures in some states, and Louisiana one of them, have just decided to ban everything. Is it the right decision? That's not for me to weigh in on, but I think that kratom itself has benefits for people, and that's why it is not being targeted by the FDA or the DEA at this point in time. But 7-OH is a public concern, health concern, and it is being targeted. It may be that 7-OH turns out to be a great thing if it's studied properly and regulated and treated right. But at the moment, it's like having morphine available at the gas station.
It's akin to buying a bottle of oxycodone or whatever at the station, correct?
Correct.
Gotcha.
Correct.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. Our Dr. Christopher McCurdy, Professor of Medicinal Chemistry at the University of Florida College of Pharmacy. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk about deep fake videos impersonating real doctors being used to push fake medical advice. And also talk to you about something that last Sunday's game had in common with the Saints-Rams no-call game. What? Interested? You'd better be. This thing runs deep. Deep. I'll tell you about it when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. Tommy Tucker, WWL, 7:45, quarter till 8. Joined now by Tony Anscombe, Chief Security of... It says evangelist. I'm guessing it's analysis, or are you an evangelist?
No, I am an evangelist.
Okay. Okay. Tell me how that works with cybersecurity, or is it?
What that means, Tommy, is I wander around the world talking about cybersecurity, the current threat landscape, and some of the problems that people might experience from cyber threats.
So, in other words, it's got nothing to do with religion. You are basically evangelizing, proselytizing about phony internet stuff?
Correct. I'm okay. Definitely not a religious evangelist.
Well, when I saw that, it confused me. So I get a chief security evangelist for cybersecurity company, ESET. Tell me about the more alarming deepfake videos that you're seeing, Tony.
Well, these deepfake videos that we've recently reported on are really concerning because they're using AI-generated deep fakes to pose as gynecologists, dietitians, or other health professionals, claiming to have, you know, not miracle cures, but certainly cures to some of the things that ailments that people might have, or promoting drugs such as weight loss, etc., and pointing them to things that aren't real. And of course, they look really convincing as they're created with AI, and it's becoming harder and harder to spot what is a deep fake and what is not.
So they are deep faking with legitimate, well-known doctors pushing their snake oil? Or what's going on? How do people know that it's not just a guy in a white coat or a woman in a white coat?
It's a mix. Some of the videos are using avatars created in AI tools, i.e. fictional people that don't exist. but others will use the images of real doctors, what I define as celebrity doctors, doctors that you might know the image of either online or from TV or such like, and they're using those images as well. So it might look like somebody familiar to you as well being used online.
Do people pass this along? And it seems like a lot of people get their information from social media, so it would seem as though all you got to do is get one or a couple of people to buy in, and then it succeeds. How successful are these deep fakes, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask you.
Well, unfortunately, they do become passed along by some people, and some people will be dragged into believing that they are real. And bear in mind, if somebody's got a medical issue, and they're looking for information and they stumble across one of these and are believing what the video says, then you're also catching them at their most vulnerable because they're looking for information and they're looking to solve a medical problem.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station today on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
So they are vulnerable to this type of content. But often this content just leads you to, drugs that actually don't do what they say they're going to do, and try and get you to buy natural supplements, as they would call them, that aren't going to perform.
I'm seeing a CBS News story in which you were quoted. One video touted a product 96% more effective than Ozempic. Do we know if it's just a benign product, or not only is it not do what it says it's going to do, but it can be harmful as well?
I believe in that instance, it just doesn't do what it says it was going to do. So it's a natural remedy that might benefit weight loss in some way, but not at the rate of Ozempic, which, as I think you and I probably know, is quite effective at weight loss.
I lost 80 pounds on it, so you're preaching to choir on this one, Tony. Do these companies, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, are they really diligent when it comes to this, or is it all about the dollars?
Well, they will take it down once they see it, once they recognize it, or once it's been reported to them. They are pretty swift at taking down the accounts that are behind these type of videos. But the problem is, as fast as you take them down, somebody can be putting them up at the other end either modifying the videos or putting the same videos back online again. So it becomes a cat and mouse game of kind of whack-a-mole of trying to stop the bad guys putting these videos online.
Now, let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about ways that we can spot AI deepfakes, which really concern me, especially when it comes to politics or whatever, because, you know, people can believe a lot of things on the Internet that aren't true, and especially if they see somebody that is purported to be President Trump saying something or some other world leader or something and get all riled up when, in fact, it's not even real. 7:50, 10 till 8, we're talking to Tony Anscombe, Chief Security Evangelist for cybersecurity company ESET, about deepfake videos impersonating real doctors used to push fake medical advice. And if you see something, as always, that seems too good to be true, chances are it is. 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:56 and a half, Tommy Tucker talking to Tony Anscombe, Chief Security Evangelist, zealot, if you will, for cybersecurity company ESET. We're talking about deep fake videos. You know, somebody texted me about an old picture that's floating around out there, and I had a new one created with an AI app. So AI is not bad because it put me in a suit I've never worn. But tell me how we can spot videos that are deep fakes, and I guess there is a difference between deep fakes and something innocent like a headshot.
Well, whether it's a deep fake photograph or a deep fake video, it's still deep fake. Okay. I mean, it's still been something that's been manipulated. But the problem is, as the AI tools get
well. Full disclosure, I may have touched that picture up a little, Tony. Thank you for bringing it up.
As long as you got rid of the gray hair and the lines.
Well, the lines are gone. There's no hair, but that's okay. Go ahead.
But they're becoming challenging to detect visually because the AI tools are getting better, and more importantly, they're becoming cheaper to use. So, i.e., the barrier to entry for somebody to create deepfake is much lower. But there are still telltale signs, you know, the incorrect background shadows in the wrong way, the eye movement, some fluctuations or differences between awkward mouth movement and the actual audio. But, you know, I think I'd come up with a slightly different rule. If you're seeing something, and I think you said it before you went to the commercial break, was, you know, if something seems too good to be true, then it probably is. I would take the view that believe nothing and verify everything.
Mm-hmm. How concerned are you, Tony, when it comes to not just consumers, but politically with deepfakes?
Well, again, I mean, a lot of people have been reliant on social media for news, and that's how they digest what's going on in the world.
And I might add, looking to believe what they want to believe already, so they might be more willing to accept a deep fake than they would to vet it, right?
Yeah, I'm not sure anything you or I can do will change human behavior on that one. But I think if you want to actually verify, you know, if you want valid information, then you need to go look for the information at the source of where the information will come from, and not trust somewhere else on the internet where it may have come from, be it social media or any other means in that way.
Anything else, Tony, on your radar about deepfakes?
Yeah, they're going to get more and more believable. It will become more challenging to detect them. And one thing I'd say is, if you've got kids, make sure your kids are aware that some of the content they're seeing online probably isn't real, the people aren't real, and they should be very skeptical of what they're looking at.
You know, as simple as it seems, Tony, what you're saying is, hey, back in the 50s, what was depicted in the movies, that wasn't real either. But it's amazing how people will suspend their disbelief now. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Tony Anscombe, Chief Security Evangelist for cybersecurity company ESET. When we come back, we're going to talk to Clancy Dubose, political editor, columnist for Gambit, and WWL political analyst about Mayor LaToya Cantrell's indictment. Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. You gosh darn right you are. And you're also listening to Clancy Dubose, WWL Louisiana analyst. How you doing, Clancy, political analyst?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I don't know where we're going to start here. You want to start with the indictment, and then we'll go to the poll?
Wherever you lead me, sir, I'll follow.
Well, it's your world. I'm living in it, Clancy.
Well, the indictment. The poll is the most recent news, but let's talk briefly about the indictment. First, New Orleans sitting mayor to be indicted. By the feds. History.
It's hard to believe, isn't it?
Not
in a way?
No, not really. No? In a way it is.
Given the shenanigans, I guess, is what I'm saying.
It's a sad day for New Orleans.
That I agree with.
Certainly sad for the mayor herself and her family and her supporters. But it's a sad day for the citizens because, you know, it's a mark against the city. You know, we have a reputation, a city and our state have a reputation nationwide for being, you know, a lot of political hijinks and tainted with corruption. And this just sort of confirms that reputation among people who want to look askance at New Orleans. But we'll get through this. We've gotten through worse. And, you know, in time, this indictment will play out. The mayor will have to make an appearance in court and enter a plea. And, you know, there's been speculation about whether there have been plea negotiations. Typically there are, but you never know how those things are going until they play out. So the city workers are hopefully, and I'm sure they are, they're dedicated. They're showing up. They're doing their jobs as best they can. And people are sort of, especially now, counting the days left till we have an election less than 2 months away and less than 4 months left, actually 5 months, I'm sorry, less than 5 months remaining in LaToya Cantrell's administration. She's the new mayor, whoever that may be, takes office on January 12th. So, you know, we've got 4.5 months to go, roughly, and we'll get there.
And look, I'm glad you said that because, and I said this yesterday, I don't take any delight in this. I think it's an embarrassment for the city. I thought at one point when I was younger that I would be happy when Ray Nagin went to prison. But when he was indicted, it didn't make me happy. It made me embarrassed for the city as well. So it's really nothing to be happy about, I don't think.
Right, exactly.
Let's talk about, you're an attorney. Compare and contrast, Nagin is a completely different thing than Nagin was charged with, right?
Right. Nagin was charged with corruption, you know, taking six figures worth of bribes and convicted on all counts, I think 20 or so counts. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison. And I remember how angry people were. They were saying, that's not enough. Mm. And, you know, so I posed the question, anybody want to trade places? You know, and I don't mean to laugh, but I mean.
No, that's a long time in prison. With 5 years in prison, a long time. A year in prison is a long time.
Yeah, and in the federal system, you serve 85% minimum. That's with good time. You serve 85% of the sentence. So
I think, Clancy, there's a misconception there that federal prison is club fed and tennis and golf and this and that and the other. Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, I would suggest just think about a country club. If I were to lock you up at pick a country club and you couldn't leave whenever you want, would you be happy with that? Really? Probably not.
No, especially if you were in a small cell and you know, the food is not good in prison. No. It's food, but it's
it ain't New Orleans Country Club.
Yeah, that's right.
Not that I've ever eaten there, but that's what I hear.
Right. No, I understand. Yeah. It's and you are told where to go, where to stand, when you can sleep, when you can get out in the yard, and it's very regimented, and it's not a lifestyle that anybody really wants. So
let me ask you this,
but in this case, but to compare and contrast,
okay,
she's charged with basically obstruction of justice. Mostly, it's about a cover up, and yes, the underlying item that is covered up is a romantic affair, an alleged romantic affair between herself and her beau, alleged beau, former police officer Jeffrey Vappi, who was her bodyguard, her favorite bodyguard, I think, by all accounts. And it's not just the affair, though. What they covered up is the fact that he was billing the city and the citizens, the taxpayers of the city, for time that he did not spend actually on duty. And it's a conspiracy charge because the mayor helped him do that. He couldn't have gotten paid an alleged $70,000 minimum. That's just for the travel that he spent on, you know, personal stuff, not actually doing the job of protecting the mayor, you know, in close quarters but arm's length, you know, not eating and drinking, as alleged in the indictment.
And even entering the residence, right? Clancy, yes, didn't I read that in the indictment?
Yes. That it is standard procedure that the Executive Protection Unit, the EPU, does not go into the mayor's residence unless there's an extraordinary need to, such as a perceived
threat or emergency or something. Yeah.
Threat or emergency to the mayor's safety.
I heard Newell yesterday say that, and Newell's an attorney, as are you, that generally speaking, if you're being asked to testify before a grand jury, the government already knows the answers to the questions, so it's best to tell the truth. Generally speaking,
exactly.
Good advice?
Very good advice. Mm. In fact, I'm reminded of something Mark Twain reportedly said. He said, "I always tell the truth. That way I don't have to remember anything."
That's true. It's true. It's absolutely true. Let me take a break, Clancy.
When
we come back, two questions. I want to talk about the poll. And also, I was with some attorney friends over the weekend, and a couple of them opined that maybe it was Mayor Cantrell's arrogance that got her indicted. And part of that includes lying to the grand jury allegedly or trying to cover it up. And we'll talk about that as well. And if she had not been so arrogant, that maybe they could have worked this out a little bit more friendly. Clancy Dubose, our guest, 821 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 826, quickly back to Clancy Dubose, WWL, Louisiana political analyst. Clancy, real quick, the, you know, lawyer friends of mine saying that maybe her arrogance got her indicted, part of that being lying to the grand jury. If she had carried herself differently and handled this differently, you think she'd be in the trouble she's in?
Oh, definitely not. She was, you know, the indictment says that she was warned more than once by close associates, people looking out for her, people who cared about her, people in her administration, friends. And, you know, she's been known to double down, even triple down and quadruple down when she's told she's wrong. She's very hard-headed. She's been compared to Donald Trump in that regard. And, you know, the president's known to double down on some of his sort of less charitable or less appealing attributes. And his supporters love him for that. And I guess the mayor's diehard supporters love her for that.
But speaking of which,
it can, it can get you into trouble.
Yeah, let me move on to the poll, and that goes to we've talked about the results before. I haven't talked about them with you. I think the audience might be familiar with them. But I thought about the garbage contract in the quarter. I thought about Oliver Thomas and how Mayor Cantrell still does have some supporters. I don't know if it's 38% or what the numbers are like President Trump has.
It's not that high.
Okay, not that high. But I always thought the garbage contract thing would be a dividing line where it's either like she was a litmus test, whatever you want to call it. She was wrong on that or she was right, and that would separate the candidates. Somebody told me they went to a forum the other day and they were talking about the indictment. Well, it seems to me the only thing you say about the indictment is I'm not going to be an idiot, and that's the best I can promise you. But when it comes to the garbage contract, Oliver Thomas, not necessarily on the side of the other council members when it comes to this garbage contract. Is that a delineating point? And to that, does Oliver Thomas gain Cantrell's support by wading into that? Do they stay away from it? The rest of the time is yours. I want to hear you.
Well, the garbage contract is one important issue, a very important issue, and it's a citywide issue, even though it pertains only to the French Quarter, because the French Quarter is something that everybody in the city of New Orleans, even in Metro New Orleans, feels that they have a stake in it, because the French Quarter is, it's been said before, it's become cliche, but it's very true. It's the crown jewel of New Orleans. And, you know, it's where we all began. It's why we're here. It's right on the bend of the river. It's why Bienville said, here's where I'm going to build a city. And, you know, it's got history, it's got culture, it's got economic significance, and it's got, an emotional appeal that tugs on our hearts. And you know, we love the French Quarter. We want to preserve it. We celebrate it with its own festival. So even though it's immediately impactful to those who live and work there, it's impactful to everyone. And yeah, I think it's a dividing line. I don't think it's necessarily going to be outside of the quarter and its immediate environs. I'm not sure that people are going to decide who to vote for based solely on that. But I think it is one factor.
I think it's linkage. I think if you don't come out against that, whomever the person is, and say that was wrong, then you're kind of siding with the Cantrell administration in a way, yourself to that and saying, you know, stay tuned, this might be more of what we have.
Well, Oliver could be siding just as equally, and maybe more so, he's siding with Troy Henry, and because he knows Troy very well. Close friends, and so it's not so much siding with the mayor. It happens to be on the side of the mayor, but I think...
But that's how it's going to be perceived, is what I'm saying.
It could be perceived, yes. Yeah. There's a perception there, absolutely.
Thank you, Clancy.
Okay, man.
I hope you come back and talk sometime.
I would love to. We didn't get to the poll, but it's interesting, and I suggest people look at WWL, you know, TV and their website. And I've talked about it quite a bit.
Well, you know what?
There's more to come.
You can come back whenever you want. You can come back tomorrow if you want. Jordan will handle all that.
Whenever you want to handle me, I'm here, brother.
I'm ready for you, brah. Thank you, Clancy.
Okay, man. Take care.
All right. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Tyler Bridges. He profiled LaToya Cantrell in 2015. And none of us are the same people we were 10 years ago, especially in this case. We'll take a look at that right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 848, quickly, Tommy Tucker, WWL, Tyler Bridges, staff writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, author of several books. Let me go straight to this Politico article that he wrote. April 16th, 2025, she's butted heads with Mayor Mitch Landrieu, who once called her a loudmouth. She's since made amends, won a seat on the city council despite an embarrassing and potentially career-ending incident involving her husband, an attorney for the city, and a joint. And she was instrumental in saving her city from being razed and turned into park land after Hurricane Katrina submerged it in 7 feet of water. This, in a nutshell, is LaToya Cantrell, and that was written by our guest, Tyler Bridges. How you doing, Tyler?
Good morning, Tommy.
Tyler's an accomplished author. You can go to tylerbridges.com. He wrote 4 books, maybe more, I don't know. But, Tyler, I got to tell you, my favorite is The Flight, A Father Was of War, A Son's Search, because my dad served in World War II, and for everybody that's a member of that generation, it's a good read.
Thanks, Tommy.
Let's talk about the LaToya Cantrell that you wrote about in 2015. I know you are a reporter, but yet you are able, I guess, factually to compare and contrast the LaToya Cantrell of 2015. First time I was exposed to her, a friend of mine that lives in Mid-City said, you know, you might want to keep an eye on her because she's doing a lot to help with Katrina recovery. And I think I was one of the first ones to put her on the air. So I take no responsibility for that. I'm just saying that's how far I go back with her. Tell me about your history with LaToya Cantrell and your thoughts about how she went from there to here.
Yeah, Tommy, in 2007, I was working for the Miami Herald, but I always looked for every opportunity I could to come back to New Orleans. So I convinced my editor to do a story on the recovery after Katrina 2 years later. And I was trying to figure out, well, where do I tell that story? And everybody said, well, you got to go to the Broadmoor neighborhood. That's the real shining star of the recovery of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I learned that Broadmoor, the plans by some people had been to turn it into park space, that they thought there was no chance for a recovery in Broadmoor. But in fact, the neighbors got together, and there was a black woman named LaToya Cantrell who was spearheading that effort with Walter Isaacson's father, and you had blacks and whites working together, young and old, saving their neighborhood. And it was just everywhere I went, I heard about LaToya Cantrell, LaToya Cantrell, that she was a real dynamo, great organizer, and that she had the folks of Broadmoor united behind her and giving hope for a new life.
So that's the LaToya Cantrell that I met that had all of this dynamic energy and strength that was applied toward the forces of good. But that's not the same LaToya. But look, you're not the same Tyler Bridges, to be fair, that you were in 2015. I'm not the same Tommy Tucker I was in 2015. Everybody changes. But how would you chart the difference here?
Well, let me first say that, you know, then I wrote the piece in 2015 for Politico magazine. Mm-hmm. And I saw that same LaToya Cantrell that I saw in 2007 that you had seen when you first were putting her on
which
the
air. Which was around that time frame, Tyler, actually around 2007, I think it was.
Okay, yeah. And she was very connected to the neighborhood. She was very connected to her community, her constituents, focusing on a lot of little small things that kind of add up to making a difference in a neighborhood. Also feisty. You read the where she took on Mitch Landrieu, then the mayor. But, you know, in 2015, she was on the city council by that point. And in the story I wrote, I forecast there's a possibility that she could be the next mayor. And just all the signs were positive. But things have changed, right?
You know, I see a quote here from Oliver Thomas in that article that says, she's one of the few people who ran for office who didn't have to say what she'd do in office. She already had a record of doing. And that is very, very true.
Absolutely. And then we get to the confounding question, Tommy, of what happened. Mm-hmm. And I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday about that, and who was making the argument that LaToya Cantrell had not changed. That, and this person was saying that when you remember the whole issue of her credit card usage and questions about that. And because I think there's a whole other school of thought, which is that it was after she was reelected that she really sort of began losing touch with her community and neighbors. But it's clear that she did lose touch with who she was back in 2007 when I saw her in Broadmoor, and the LaToya Cantrell that I saw again in 2015, again, who was so connected to neighbors and communities, and she just that's hard to see her today as being like that.
Latoya Cantrell of 2007 would never have checked out like Mayor Cantrell did after the start of the second term. Agreed?
Absolutely.
And the undying question is, what happened? Where did it all go so wrong? Tell me about, would you like to talk to her again and sit down and have a no BS conversation, although the word did come up during the interview in Politico, with her and just, I know she won't do it now because she's under indictment, after all of this is over?
I would love to pose these same questions to her. I think these are questions, Tommy, that you have, that I have, that the community at large, not just the people in New Orleans, of course, your listeners, many of them don't live in New Orleans, mm-hmm. but it's important for all of us that all New right. Orleans succeeds. And you got to have a good mayor. And I think there is just widespread dissatisfaction and disappointment and sadness the way things have gone under her. Whether she turns out to be found guilty or not, clearly the city is not heading in the right direction.
And look, I'm not one to judge, and I just wonder, I think it'd be, and I'm not in any way implying the mayor has psychological problems, that's not what I'm saying, but I think it would be interesting for either a sociologist or a behavioralist or whatever the title would be to look at this as a case study.
Yeah, and we can all play amateur psychologists. Mm-hmm. There were some people who say that she lost her head by falling in love with this guy, and you know, there's a sad family story. Her mm-hmm. husband died. She has a teenage daughter. Other people will say, no, she was corrupt all along. Other people say she just kind of got arrogant, as the way people can do in political office. One thing we can say is that things are not headed in the right direction in New Orleans for whatever reason under her.
Tyler, pleasure as always. Go to TylerBridges.com. You can't lose with anything he's written. And I think what's important that you just said is that she's got a teenage daughter and that, you know, politically aside, these are real people that we're talking about in real people's lives. Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
You bet. 855, 5 till 9, traffic now, WWL. Which brings us to our next guest, David Weigel, an astrophysicist and planetarium director for the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning. Glad to be here and, you know, waking up.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it. an astrophysicist, so I'm guessing you couldn't make it as a communications major?
Actually, I'd beg to differ. I do love science, but I love to talk about it as well. And
well, that's
my
good.
My job is literally science communication.
There you go. I was just kidding around with you and putting myself down in a way. Let's talk about... I was born on August the 11th. I had a birthday just recently, and my mother used to tell me I was born on the night of the shooting stars, which was the Perseid meteor shower, I think. Is that over with or not?
Sort of wrapping up at this point. It's a really great meteor shower to get some bright meteors and pretty good density of meteors, but mm-hmm. you know, we got something else pretty good happening right now as well.
Which is?
Well, it's a planetary parade, and the planetary parade is kind of a bit of a media-driven term, but it's basically the idea that at some point throughout the year, and not exactly consistently, mm-hmm. we have a variety of planets that can appear to sort of line up in the sky, which is due to really just orbital mechanics of how planets orbit around the sun in our solar system, but it makes for something really nice to point out, and in this case, if you go in the early morning, and really tomorrow is probably the last good day to see it, mm-hmm. but early morning about, 45 minutes before sunrise, probably in the 4:50 a.m. to 5:15 a.m. Looking east and then kind of across the horizon towards the west, there's six planets lined up.
What planets?
And rather bright.
What planet? And first of all, we wouldn't know, but is Earth, if somebody were looking from a different direction, would Earth be part of that alignment or not?
That's a great question, and actually, yes. So, if we were looking from outside of our solar system, with a really really powerful telescope mm-hmm. or something, and looking at our solar system kind of edge on, then yeah, sure, you'd see all of the planets kind of lined up nicely. But that's something that you would see fairly regularly if you were looking at our solar system from edge on.
So 4:50 to 5 o'clock here, that's central time you're talking about, David?
That's Central Time, correct.
Okay, so, man, I'm up. I'm here at work. I'll just have to go outside and look. But it has to be a clear night. Where am I looking? What sky?
Mostly in the eastern sky, but then kind of towards zenith and a little bit past, meaning kind of straight up in the sky. And the sixth planet you can see is a little bit misleading in that Mercury is very low on the horizon, so you need a really good, clear view of the eastern sky. Then you've got Venus, which is the brightest thing in the sky, not named the sun or the moon. Mm-hmm. And Venus and Jupiter are really close to each other right now. They were in conjunction a few days ago. That means kind of a close proximity from our perspective, not really in 3D space, but from our perspective. And they're moving slowly further apart as the days go on. And tomorrow morning, not part of the planetary conjunction, but our planetary parade, but very pretty, is a very thin crescent of the moon right next to them. And then as you continue on that way, you can also see Uranus if you have a telescope. It's not naked eye visible. And then marching much further towards the western, almost southwestern sky is Saturn, bright and pretty. And next to Saturn is Neptune, definitely not bright, but pretty if you can see it through a telescope.
I bought a telescope for my kid way back in the day, and I don't know if it was defective or I was defective. Is it that – how hard is it, David, for the amateur to get a – and I know you don't endorse products, but when it comes to telescope, if somebody's listening to this like, you know what, that's pretty cool. I want to get up with my kid to look at this. How would you advise them to go about getting a telescope? What are the parameters
sure thing.
That you would –
That's a great question. And, I guess if we're talking just like generically how to pick a telescope, really the best telescope for you is the one that fits in your budget that, you're actually going to use. And so what I mean by that is, with telescopes, bigger is absolutely better, in terms of seeing. But bigger is also heavier and clunkier and, you know, sort of a pain to get out. So, generally, if you're willing to spend somewhere in the, you know, $150 to $600, you can get a pretty solid telescope that you can see some nice things. For planetary viewing, honestly, even something like binoculars are going to be okay, especially for the brighter planets. Something like a Venus, you'd be able to see the phases of Venus. For Jupiter, you'll be able to see maybe a few of its brightest moons. For the moon, binoculars are fantastic. I mean, the only difficulty is holding them as still as possible. Another option that I really like that's fairly new are the idea of smart telescopes. So these are telescopes that can be pretty...
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station today on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
Cost effective, a few under that $500 price point.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically integrate that light in real time. So what that means is just like your eyes see like a singular snapshot in time, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can take pictures of the thing through the telescope and it keeps stacking the images as you watch. And the image gets better and better and better the longer you watch it. Eventually you sort of run out of how good it can be. But yeah, even over the course of a few minutes, it's increasingly impressive. And so sort of two different philosophies of, you know, viewing through an eyepiece versus viewing a screen, like maybe on an iPad. Beautiful in both cases.
I see one of these things, a Dwarf 3 smart telescope that looks a lot like a rangefinder you would use on a golf course. I had no idea they were that small. Or when it comes to smart telescopes, I got to be honest, I'm no astrophysicist, so obviously when I look up in the sky, you probably see a lot more things, David, than would I or any civilian, if you want to use that term. So if we don't have a smart telescope, how would we go about as a starting point, a reference point or whatever, to then work our way toward the planets?
Sure thing. So for this specific event, I would say look towards the eastern sky if you know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
And basically,
well, your phone will tell you that, right?
Sunrise.
I mean, you put your phone on compass, so that is I'm being serious because a lot of people don't know. That's
sure.
A starting point. So put the phone on compass and look toward the eastern sky. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I can even say too that there's plenty of apps that you can download that are free or not very expensive,
mm-hmm.
that will show you where various things are in the sky. I would say that you really don't need to pay for an app to show you that. Some paid apps give you a little bit more features, but for something simple, yeah, free apps like I don't even know, Google Sky maybe, mm-hmm. is still a thing, or something like Stellarium. But so put your phone on compass, look towards the eastern sky. You probably will see a little bit of a glow in the early morning of the sun about to rise. And the brightest thing that you can see in that eastern sky will be Venus.
Okay.
And as you look kind of towards, draw a line sort of towards the horizon with Venus, nearby that line, there should be something else kind of bright. That would be Mercury. And Mercury, as the days increase, is getting closer and closer to the sun. And then right next to Venus, something else really bright is Jupiter. So again, tomorrow morning, Venus, Jupiter, and the moon are going to be in this sort of triangular pattern. Very, very bright and very pretty.
So the moon would be
highly,
maybe a starting point, right? The moon, you could work your way down from that, left and right, or not?
Sure. So actually, yes, I'll just say that the moon will be such a tiny crescent. It's waning and only a couple days away from a new moon.
Mm-hmm.
And so since it is so tiny, a sliver, it might not be immediately obvious. You would hope it would be, but let's say it could be overlooked. But those three things in the sky should be pretty clear and fairly easy to pick out.
Let me take a break, David. What we've done, for those that listen regularly know, we've kind of changed what we do from a typical talk show, since it's the morning and, you know, with that, I got to tell you what's wrong with this. I'll tell you what's wrong with that. We kind of do more like podcasts and informational segments. And this is one of them, talking with David Weigel, an astrophysicist
awesome.
And planetarium director for the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. When we come back, we'll talk about space camp. And if y'all have any questions about the parade of planets, you can text them into the Oquinar Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. No texting and driving, and I'll pass them along. We're calling it the Planet Parade, but we here are used to parades where they throw things, and we don't want these planets throwing anything at us, I don't think. 921, back in a flash, WWL. We are talking to David Weigel, an astrophysicist and planetarium director for the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, about the Planetary Parade. Doc, somebody texted in and wanted to know about telescopes that record, so they could set it up and then go back and watch it, I guess, and fast forward or whatever they want to do, or preserve it. Do you know if they make such a thing?
Sure thing. So that's actually a little bit of what I was just explaining before. So some of these smart telescopes, you could literally do just that. You could set it up, have it connected to your phone or to a tablet or something, and you could go back inside, and as long as you're within, you know, connection range for it, you can literally do the observing remotely from your living room. And again, like, could be at a sub $500 price point. So, it's a pretty comfortable and exciting and simple thing.
So I'm looking at your Instagram account, until it kicked me off because I didn't log in. You got some great pictures there. I'm trying to find a password now so I can keep looking at it. That's a true story. So when it comes to your, how can people follow you on social media and see the stuff that you post?
Sure thing. You're talking about the Rocket Center?
Yeah. Or you personally?
Absolutely. So, you probably don't want to follow me, but...
whatever it is. I looked up David Weigel, and I saw some pictures of the nice pictures that you've taken of different things in the sky, et cetera.
Sure thing. Well, so I guess Rocket Center USA across most social media platforms. If you do want to follow me, A. David Weigel, that's A-D-A-V-I-D-W-E-I-G-E-L on Instagram, and do have a few astro photos and some climbing, you know, gotta do it all.
Yeah, now it says enter the code and WhatsApp, and I'm not doing all that stuff, so we'll figure it out later. Tell me about Space Camp.
Sure thing. Well, Space Camp is awesome. There's really no other way to put it. We are the longest running STEM camp in the world, mm-hmm. and it is a very full-bodied experience where we really teach you all the things you need to know about being an astronaut and going to space. So there are, you know, simulated missions where you can train to be an astronaut, quite literally. We have, you know, various lessons throughout and activities that help, you know, mold people's minds in the way of just critical thinking, specifically for, you know, problem solving for different, you know, science-related things. Everyone goes to the planetarium, to the Intuitive Planetarium, and get these live and interactive, immersive experiences. And that's my baby, so that's what I'm most excited about.
And it's not that far away. It's in Huntsville, Alabama, right?
In Huntsville, Alabama. Absolutely. Rocket City, USA.
So everybody's got a story, and I want to hear yours. How do you go from, because, you know, I saw your picture, and I'm not trying to comment on your appearance or anything, but you hardly look like a nerd. You talk about rock climbing and mountain climbing and so forth. What made you get so interested, and how hard is it to be an astrophysicist?
That's a fair question. Well, I've always really just been very fascinated with the unknown and exploration. And so, you know, that drives me here on the Earth to go explore things and, you know, national parks or that sort of thing. But it drives my interest in trying to explore the universe. And I mean, that sounds pretty cliche, and maybe it is. But yeah, I think it's just really neat looking at all the different research coming out from, you know, every single institution and the different telescopes on Earth and in space, et cetera. And for me, research is very fascinating, and it's neat to be on the cutting edge of a very, you know, niche topic. I, as a planetarium director, have this unique opportunity to be involved in the latest and greatest of everything, mm-hmm. because it's my job to bring those discoveries to the public in a way that is understandable, that's compelling, that's beautiful. And I'm very passionate about visualization of all of these things so that we take this data, we make these immersive, beautiful experiences that people can explore the wonders of the universe and our latest and greatest understanding. So it is big, sure, but it's something that's absolutely attainable. It's hard work, but, you know, anyone can do it.
Have you been through the what do you call them, astronaut training or not?
Through space camp?
Yeah.
So that's a sort of a painful story.
Yeah, that's what I was asking. I thought it might be.
In school, I actually didn't get to go. My elementary school went, and they swapped the grades right when I was moving into fifth grade. They moved it down to fourth grade, mm-hmm. and so I didn't get to go as a kid. I did get to go after I started working here at the U.S. Space Rocket Center, where I've been for about 6 years now. And it's an amazing time, like I said. And for those of you who are like me and have missed out, do know that we offer adult camps and family camps. So it's never too late to come back. And we're in the process of refreshing our experiences dramatically. We have some new construction underway for a whole new building called Inspiration 4 that will really revitalize our simulations and get them really cutting edge. So the future is very bright and exciting.
If somebody's never been in a planetarium, what would you tell them?
Ooh, great question there, too. So I think a lot of people have been to planetariums a long time ago, and they think of this, you know, domed room that's kind of comfortable and maybe sleepy and somebody, you know, talking about the night sky. But the modern planetarium is very different than that. Yes, it still may be comfortable and a little bit sleepy because you're turning out the lights. But the technology with digital planetariums is so, so impressive. So for us, we have, you know, very high-end technology. You might think about, like, the Sphere in Las Vegas or something like that, where it's this huge dome screen, but we can put anything on that screen. And so when you come into the Intuitive Planetarium at the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, you have the opportunity to fly literally anywhere in the universe. And because our shows are live and interactive, either myself or someone on my team is the audience's personal tour guide to the universe on the topic at hand. So we can fly over the surface of Mars and see data at 25 centimeters per pixel. That's 10 inches per pixel. If there's a football-sized rock on Mars, we can show you that.
Wow.
We can fly to the edge of the universe and look at trillions of galaxies. Like, it, you know, the sky is quite literally not the limit. And so we have the ability to visualize all these things and then also explore this kind of collectively. So it's not a lecture. It's not, you know, a talk, but it's mutual discovery. And sure, we can show you the planetary parade and we can show you what to look for in the night sky, but then we can fly you beyond the surface of our planet and take you anywhere in that cosmos. And it's a really, really powerful and unique thing.
It's about a 7-hour drive, so it would be an overnight thing. But are there weekend packages or something, David, if somebody wants to bring the family?
I guess
or just daily
tickets? The Rocket Center, the best way would be, from a package standpoint, would be like an adult space camp or a family space camp sort of situation. Or, I mean, you know, bring your kids and you come to the planetarium.
Just get your day tickets before you go because it sells out or not?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say specifically for the Intuitive Planetarium, every Friday we host a series called Cocktails and Cosmos. It's a new show every week that we produce for that week. They're all live and interactive as well on topics that are, you know, relevant to the latest and greatest in astronomy. So like this week, we're talking about the Vera Rubin Observatory and its first images that were released earlier this summer. And we have a hotel right on campus. It's the Marriott Hotel right on campus. So, and several more within a 5-minute drive. So very, very easy to get out there for the weekend and check things out. And highly, highly recommended in my very biased opinion.
And what is the site, David, where people go?
Rocketcenter.com.
Pretty simple.
Rocketcenter.com, and that can get you to Space Camp. That can get you to the U.S. Space and Rocket Center Museum. That can get you to the Intuitive Planetarium. And you can find out more. And again, Rocket Center USA on Facebook, Instagram, X, YouTube. Kind of run the gamut there.
All right, let me run this through because I want to clear everything up. Somebody texted and said, just because somebody likes space makes them a nerd, how disrespectful of you, damn it. I certainly hope you know, David, that I was not disrespecting you. What I was saying is that it's cool to be an astrophysicist. STEM subjects are cool, and that would be an excellent way to expose your children to it, to see, to show them that not everybody that is, proving the point, not everybody that is interested in space or science is a nerd. If anything, it makes you the smartest one in the room.
Well, I appreciate it, but and no respect, disrespect was taken. I completely agree. You know, we get very nerdy about this sort of thing, and it's so much fun. Whether you're really passionate about space or you're just a little bit curious, I think anytime you go into the Intuitive Planetarium, you know, there's something for you. And again, at Cocktails and Cosmos specifically, you know, it's a very casual, laid back environment. And, you know, we're showing you these beautiful things. Maybe you get a good drink and there's a little bit of comedy as well. And we don't shy away from, you know, some of the heavier science, but we also convey it in a way that's for everybody. And people leave very, very, very happy, and they come back
from a communication standpoint, which is where we started this. It's interesting that you start with cocktails and not cosmos.
Yes. Well, I guess twofold.
There you go.
One, it is linear.
Yeah.
You start with the cocktails and or a mocktail or just popcorn, I guess, and then you get the cosmos. But two, that's a little bit punchy to ring you in of, ooh, Friday night event. Let's see what we can do.
The perfect marriage of communications and astrophysicistry, if that's the word, with David saying it's linear. I love that. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. And let me tell you this, personally, every astrophysicist that we've ever had on have been the coolest people I've ever spoken to. So thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Hopefully we'll have you again.
Thank you.
So
Thank you. Would love to be. Appreciate it.
5:40 to 6 o'clock tomorrow, Eastern Sky, and go from there. Right?
Oh, that's correct. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. Come back, talk with Jeff Nowak about the Saints 939 traffic, WWL. 9:46, 14 till 10. Let me clean this up. I think I mistakenly said the planetary parade was 5:40 to 6 is going to be too late if you get up then. It's 4:40 until 5 o'clock, just to be clear. Jeff Nowak joins us now, WWL Saints sideline reporter, digital producer. Jeff, it's just shocking, the NFL. It's traveling around the world like you wouldn't believe this this travesty that you and Mike Haas exposed about the end of the preseason game. Tell us about it.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know how much I exposed it as much as, you know, the refs, I think, may have had some dinner reservations they wanted to get to. Yeah, I mean, if anyone who watched the end of that, you know, it's funny, I don't know how many people actually watched the end of that game, because most fans, I think, don't get to the end of a preseason game. In this case, you had Spencer Rattler out there. I think people wanted to see him.
Yeah,
so maybe there was a higher percentage. But, yeah, that final play, Jonas Anker, Rajan Wright tips the ball up to Jonas Anker, turns what would have been a long field goal attempt to win it for the Jags into a tie. But, yeah, I mean, I think anyone watching that on TV, everyone in the building looked up, saw Jonas go down, and it's like, oh, there's a second left on the clock. Well, the refs disagreed, but you watch it on TV. I had someone say, like, oh, that's not official. I mean, it's official. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to know what the time is, and the replays are pretty clear that there was a second left, but whatever. It's a tie. It's preseason. You can move on. I think in the regular season, that gets reviewed a lot more closely, and they put
absolutely.
A second back on the clock.
Absolutely.
It would have been nice to see Charlie Smith get a chance to kick a game winner, but hey, we can talk about a tie.
How long of a field goal would it have been?
Oh, I haven't gone back and looked. I guess it'd be around 50 yards. He did get past the 40-yard line, so it would have been a makeable kick. And he had already made two field goals on the day, so it would have been a good opportunity for him. But, again, it's like the result doesn't matter, so you just move on.
Yeah, since we're there, let's talk about that. He's got no shot at unseating the name
Blake
flies
Groupie.
Out of my head.
Groupie,
you're right.
Yeah. I mean, for a few reasons. One, he really struggled with his consistency early in camp. You know, what his kind of best skill is he has this kind of generational leg in terms of I'm pretty sure he can make a kick comfortably from 65-70 yards. But the problem is that's not how you're picking your kicker. You're picking your kicker based on are you making the kicks that we're going to ask you to make the most in games, you know? And so that means yeah you want him to be consistent from 50 to 59. Most NFL kickers today can be that. It's are you going to make a like 95% of your kicks inside 40? And that's, you know, Blake, I think on the kicks we've seen him in practices, I think he's something like 34 of 35. You know, he made from 51 the other day. So he's making it at like a 98% clip.
Yeah, and it's hard to – you can't pass that up. You can't,
right, like
no.
Charlie could have been the most consistent kicker in the NFL through, you know, the first 2 weeks, and he'd still have a hard time unseating Blake. So it's good to see Charlie kind of rebuilding that confidence because – he's 4-for-4 in the preseason games where he's had a chance to kick. He's 3-for-3 this year. He also had to make from 50 yards. So, you know, like the Saints can keep him on the practice squad. Mm-hmm. They get an extra spot through the International Pathway Program for another year. Yeah, so I think they will keep him around.
Yeah, absolutely.
But here's the thing. If he had gone out and missed all three of his kicks in the games, they may have just said, like, yeah, I mean, you know, good luck. Like, we're going to move on. So it's good to see him kind of rebuilding that confidence because, again, I think – you know, maybe with another year of seasoning and on a practice squad, you come back next training camp, have another shot at it, and maybe you kind of pick it up. But no, Blake's going to be your kicker, and I think the Saints are excited about Blake.
Let's talk about quarterback. It makes no difference to me because I can say, the Shaka, as easily as I can say, the Rattler. Who's got the lead, do you think, going into either game three, or how are they going to manage the quarterback play in game three?
We'll see. You know, I'd like to think that they make a decision this week, and whether they announce it as this is our starting quarterback, I think whoever gets out there and starts the final preseason game, you know, that's probably your starter, right? Because I think you're going to want to get him all the first-team reps you can throughout the week in practice. You know, like week one is going to be here before you know it. Like they're going to have an off week, so there'll be some time. You know, you have kind of that two-week window after Saturday's preseason game, but you got to know, man, someone's going to go out there and play and play when the real bulls start flying. And so you want to make a decision. My guess is at this point, it's going to be Rattler. You know, if you go based on statistics, it's about as close as it could get. I think one guy is like 24 of 34. The other guy is 25 of 35. Both guys have led touchdown drives. One touchdown drive, both guys have led two drives that resulted in field goals. Both guys have executed in 2 minute scenarios. Tyler was his first drive in the NFL last week against the Chargers. Spencer was the game tying drive with the 2-point conversion this week against the Jaguars. So, you know, from that perspective, it's about as close as it can get. So it's going to come down to, okay, what are the grades? Like who do you have graded higher? Who's making the better decisions the majority of the time, right? And I think at this stage, they're probably going to have a little more confidence in Spencer to go out there week one and have some success. I'm still in the situation now where I expect both quarterbacks to play at some point in this season. If that's the case, then I want to go with Spencer first because that gives me the trigger of, hey, things aren't going well. I'm going to go to the rookie and see what he has. I really don't want to have to do that the other way around, right?
Yeah, I heard the canon, the birthday boy, opine about that, where it's better to start Rattler because if for whatever reason the team gets off to a bad start or he gets off to a bad start, it's a lot easier to then turn to Shuck than it would be the other way around.
Exactly, and I think you can also do that without destroying a young player's confidence.
Right.
Right, and I think that's got to be an important part of this conversation. If Tyler was playing head and shoulders above Spencer, then yeah, you go with Spencer. If Spencer came out and didn't look like he could hack it, then you go with Tyler. But like, I don't see that. I see a second year guy who seems like he's taken steps forward, and I see a young player who has progressed extensively throughout camp, but still I feel like has some time left to grow. So that's where I'd be right now, and I just hope that we don't drag this out through the final preseason game, because I just don't see how that benefits anybody.
You are welcome anytime you want to come on, Jeff. I appreciate your time. Real quick, when's your birthday?
March 11th. Me and Anthony Davis share a birthday party. I'm still waiting for the combo party. You know, maybe someday he'll get back here, but for now, it's just me on March 11th.
Mm. He might overshadow you anyway, literally.
Maybe a little bit. He is tall.
Big guy, yeah. Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure as always. Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter, digital producer. It is Bobby Hebert's birthday today, as well as Saints legend Morton Anderson. So if you want to text the cannon this afternoon, I'm sure he'd appreciate your birthday wishes. 9:54, we'll take a break, come back, find out what Newell's got planned for us today here on WWL.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station today on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.